ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When I say productivity, how do you react? Do you feel like it's a critical goal for your working life, or do you perhaps question the singular focus on productivity gains that seem to have pushed many to burnout? Hello, Lisa Leong here for This Working Life, helping to make your work life better. This episode, we're shining a light on the concept of productivity, and in particular, exploring an approach called slow productivity. In your particular professional field, how would most people define productivity or being productive? You can email thisworkinglife@abc.net.au. Cal Newport is a best-selling author and a computer science professor at Georgetown University and a longtime advocate for making changes to the way we work. You may remember him from his book Deep Work, and we last chatted with him on This Working Life about emails. His latest book is Slow Productivity, The Lost Art of Accomplishment Without Burnout. Welcome back, Cal.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Good to talk to you again.
So a few years back, you noticed the start of a backlash against the concept of productivity. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
I began to hear it from my readers of my newsletter as well as my podcast listeners that when I would deploy the term productivity, which shows up in my work for years, I began to get responses that would say, you know, do we have to use that word? Or isn't there another way we could talk about this? And I began to realize there's something changing out here in this culture where something that we once just thought of as like, yeah, this is what you do at work. You try to be productive. The key is how do you do it? Something was changing where our relationship to that term was beginning to fray a little bit. People were beginning to get upset about what that term was implying.
Why were they upset?
What seems to have happened is that we hadn't confronted what that term was actually supposed to mean. So there's a really clear definition for productivity if you run a farm. It's how many bushels of wheat do you produce per acre of land you have. There's a really clear definition for that term if you run a factory, like how many Model T automobiles are produced per paid worker hour in your factory. And if you can make that number go up, whatever you're doing is more productive. But in office work, that type of measure doesn't make sense anymore. We don't just do one thing. Each individual is working on many different projects. What I'm working on is different than what the person next to me is working on. There's no clear way of measuring how productive are you being in some quantitative sense. And because of that, productivity became a sort of hazy, catch-all, almost psychological term. And I think as knowledge work got busier and busier, and then the pandemic came and pushed us even farther, people begin to get fed up with the sort of haziness of, wait, what do we really mean by this? The way people seem to be using it is making me less happy and doesn't seem to be producing much value.
It results in something called pseudo-productivity. What's that?
This was the fallback sort of band-aid solution that knowledge work invented to deal with the reality that we don't actually have a way of measuring productivity with hard numbers. And so pseudo-productivity is the belief that visible effort can be a reasonable proxy for producing value. So pseudo-productivity says the more I see you doing, just the more activity I see you doing, which in a digital age, by the way, means the quicker I see you responding to emails, the more times I see you active on Slack channel, the more Zoom invitations that you accept and show up to, the more busyness I see, the more valuable I'll assume you are. But pseudo-productivity is not actually a real measure of value being produced by an individual organization. It's just a rough rule of thumb that managers put in place because they didn't know what else to measure.
This is really resonating. And so I guess what happens then is that with pseudo-productivity, this leads to this feeling of overwhelm and potentially burnout.
This was the narrative I basically uncovered in my research, is that first you get knowledge work emerges as a major economic sector. You know, in the US, this begins in the mid-20th century and it sort of spreads worldwide throughout the 20th century. At first, pseudo-productivity, you know, it's not a great measure, but it was okay. It meant, okay, I'm at the office. I better look busy when the boss walks by. Don't be at the water cooler too long. If you want to seem really productive, come a little early and stay a little late. Where things began to go off the rail was the digital revolution. So first, when we put computers on the desk of every worker, what this did is it vastly increased the number of things you could be doing. And then we had the communication revolution with email and then Slack and then mobile communication through things like laptops and smartphones. And now suddenly the granularity at which you could demonstrate your activity became really small. Now I can moment to moment answer an email or be on Slack. Whether I'm at the office or not doesn't really matter. I can now demonstrate activity when I'm at home and on the weekend and in the evening. And I think it was the combination of computers and networks with pseudo-productivity is where knowledge work began to go off the rails. And we can just see this. If you look at self-reports of people feeling stressed or burnt out at work, when do these start going up? The early 2000s. What's happening in the early 2000s? We all got plugged in. So there's a digital story here that I think helps explain the psychological reality that a lot of burnt out knowledge workers feel today.
Here's a message from this working lifer, Tara.
Unfortunately, productivity is usually defined by what things can be counted, regardless of whether those things matter. And that's frustrating because it feels like whoever we report to doesn't understand our work. Sometimes that's a gift, because you can fly under the radar. But if you want to be heard, you need to speak the language of managers, and data is the language. If you can control your data, you can tell your story how you want to, and maybe that will help your work be understood.
Cal, reflections on that?
You know, it reminds me of something I heard not long ago from someone who was in sales at a major tech company. And they told me the sales group at this company, unique among all of the different groups at this company, doesn't have to go to meetings, right? It's just optional whether or not you want to accept it or not. And I said, well, why is that? What's different about sales? And they said, oh, we have numbers. I can say, I brought in this much money last quarter. That is a good number. I am being productive. I don't have to go through the hoops of being everywhere and showing up to all of the things. I thought it was really insightful because I think the response here is absolutely hitting a reality is because it's hard for so many other jobs for you to directly measure, here's how many widgets I produce and how much value that brought. You have no other choice but to fall back into, man, I better be busy because how else am I going to convince my manager that I'm doing something useful?
Lisa Leong here for This Working Life on ABC Radio National. My guest is Cal Newport, best-selling author, computer science professor at Georgetown University, and his latest book is called Slow Productivity, The Lost Art of Accomplishment Without Burnout. In your particular professional field, how do you define productivity or being productive? You can email thisworkinglife@abc.net.au. Cal, it's time to reveal slow productivity. Maybe if you can tell us about how you formally define slow productivity.
Well, I think about it as a move away from busyness and towards actual results, moving towards producing things that are quality and away from just producing a lot of activity. And I think there's three key principles. So in my formal definition, I say the three things that seem to matter to make that shift is going to be doing fewer things, working at a natural pace, but at the same time also obsessing over the quality of what you do.
So do fewer things. Should we start with the concept of overhead tax?
I mean, this is what makes this idea actually work because it's the idea when I first stated do fewer things scares more people than any other idea I talk about. People imagine this is the end of my career if I listen to this advice. But overhead tax, that concept is what I think is going to make this more palatable. So overhead tax is what you have to pay in a sort of time sense when you accept a task or a project. So when I take on a commitment, there's going to be emails I have to send about it. There's going to be meetings I'm going to have to attend just to collaborate with people. There's going to be cognitive thoughts I'm going to have to dedicate towards it, you know, because it takes logistical effort to actually try to run a task or project. The problem we have today is that if we say yes to too many things or managers put too many things on our plate, each of those things brings with it its own overhead tax. And this overhead tax begins to aggregate. And if I'm working on enough things simultaneously, the amount of my day that now has to be dedicated to dealing with this overhead tax, with this administrative overhead, becomes overwhelming. And soon it becomes most of my day. And when most of my day is talking about work, dealing with the logistics of work, there's very little time left for me to actually do the work itself. And we become not only unhappy, but we become really slow at actually getting anything done. So I think having too many things at your plate at the same time It's like putting too many logs down the river if you're a lumberjack. Eventually, it's going to jam up and it's going to make you way less successful.
And you had the example of a poor manager who just had days and days of Zoom calls.
I mean, this really became an issue in the pandemic where we switched meetings over to Zoom because two things happened at the same time. One, just because of the shift to remote work, the amount of things we had to do jumped up a bit because we had to adjust our businesses to deal with remoteness. And two, we moved all interaction to Zoom, but Zoom takes at least a half hour per meeting because it's hard to drag a smaller block than that on your calendar. So we had this phenomenon of people who were finding my entire day was back-to-back Zoom. I profiled a manager who ended up having a heart attack in the book, and he referred to this as the Zoom apocalypse. But I had podcast listeners who would write into me and say, my number one problem right now in, you know, the summer of 2020 is I don't have time to go to the bathroom. That is how fully packed my day is with Zoom, which is, of course, an absurdity because the Zoom meetings are talking about work, but you actually have to do the work at some point. You can't make your entire day just conversations about work. But in a pseudo-productivity regime, that's the type of absurdity that can emerge.
Now, why is doing fewer things not accomplishing less things?
Well, if we go back to this overhead tax idea, what happens if you're working on fewer things right now, like today? Less of my day is going to be dedicated to overhead tax. I'll have more time left to actually work on the things themselves. So the smaller number of things I'm working on, I'm going to get done faster because I can spend a lot more time on it, and it's going to be more quality time, not fragmented time in between meetings, but long, unbroken stretches of time. So now the average time required to finish a task is going to greatly reduce. So yes, like right now at this moment, maybe I'm only working on two things instead of five, but the number of things I finished this week might be larger than if I tried to do all of them at the same time. So the throughput, the rate at which you finish things actually goes up when you reduce the number of things you work on at the same time.
What if my manager perceives this as laziness?
Well, there's a real psychological minefield to navigate if you're trying to implement this idea all by yourself. If you can implement this idea as a team, oh, it's so much easier because as a team, you can just say, hey, let's keep track of the things our team needs to do separately from what each individual is doing. And we can be very careful about like how much we put on anyone's plate at the same time. And it works fantastic. And I case study and profile organizations to do this, and it's great. If you're an individual, however, it's more fraught because if you come to your manager and give them a whole speech about overhead tax and administrative overhead and aggregation and lumberjack, so it's hard to just say no if you're the only person doing this. So what I talk about in the books is either better ways to say no or ways to turn yeses into not being so impactful on your schedule. So for example, you might differentiate between the things you've agreed to do that you're working on right now and the things you've agreed to do that you're not working on yet. And you can have those things in some list and you can publish it in a shared document and you can point people towards it. But you tell people if they try to email you, set up a meeting about something in that second list, you say, no, it's in my waiting queue. But as soon as it moves to my active queue, I'm gonna call you and we're gonna get into it. And what you've done there is not said no to anything, but you've reduced the number of things that you have to have overhead tax for at any one moment. So there are things you can do. It's more complicated, but there are for sure things you can do even as an individual that don't require you just to say to your manager, not doing it. No. There's a little more subtlety here that you can emerge. I've also found that when people sit down with numbers, this is feedback I got, when they sit down with like actual examples and numbers and talk to a manager, breakthroughs are possible that they thought were never going to happen before. So when you talk in the abstract about these concepts, a manager might say, I don't know what this is. This makes me feel uncomfortable. This makes me feel like stuff is not going to get done. But if you instead say, look, I'm going to run an experiment here. Yeah, I know this sounds weird, this like waiting list and this active list or whatever, but let me just report back to you in 2 weeks, okay? And you come back in 2 weeks and say, see, actually, I got all of these things done. And here's the average time this lasted here. And this is actually more things being accomplished than when I tried to do these all at the same time. And I know this is a little bit weird, but you know what? It's working well for me and I'm getting a lot more done because of it. Numbers talk. And a lot of time managers, we think that they're aren't going to budge on things, but they will if they see like, oh, this is working better. It's just sometimes harder than you think to make that case. So I think having real examples really does make a difference.
All right, let's go to the second principle, work at a natural pace. How do we determine this, Cal?
Well, we like to think that if you're productive, you got to get going right away and finish things as quickly as possible. Slow down a little bit. You can take your time. You can take breaks. There's not some idea that if you don't finish this as quickly as possible, it doesn't matter. You might as well catch your breath along the way and enjoy your life along the way. Good stuff is going to be good stuff, whether you do it in 6 months or it takes 9 months. So it's really this idea of like, we can slow down, we can have more variation, we can take longer to do the stuff that matters.
Why don't we do this?
Well, in a pseudo-productivity regime, we're worried about ever slowing down. So in a pseudo-productivity regime, we have basically put ourselves in the, you know, what I call the virtual factory, where we clock in and we're at a sort of abstract assembly line trying to work furiously all day long and then clock back out at the end. Because if visible activity is our measure of you being useful, I never want to show you me doing anything other than furious activity. So we always want to be busy. We always want to be doing things because pseudo-productivity says that's what matters. But as soon as you throw that out, you say, actually, maybe having a busy day and a less busy day is going to be better for my output in the long run. Maybe having a season where I'm really locked in on a big project, but then I take 2 weeks after that's done and just sort of find myself, recharge, and sort of think, what do I want to work on next? Maybe that's actually going to be better over the course of a whole year. Maybe if I spend 2 years producing this book instead of 9 months, it's going to be such a better book that it's going to have more impact. So once we leave pseudo-productivity behind, we no longer see time as something that has to be filled or it's bad. We see it as something that we're ebbing and flowing with. That's a much more natural relationship with time. The relationship we've had as a species basically for most of our existence until just recently.
What's one practical thing we can do in terms of this working at a natural pace?
So I want you to get away from having every day being all out all day long, indistinguishable from every other workday. And there's like a couple simple practical things you can do just to start experimenting with this. One really easy thing, have a day where you don't schedule meetings and don't make a big deal about it and don't announce it and don't give a big speech about it or whatever. Just when people ask you, hey, when are you available for this call? Give them tons of options. Just don't happen to give them an option on that one day. Make it a Monday if possible or a Friday so you can kind of connect to a weekend. It's a small thing, but having that day feel different than other days, feel a little bit less pressured, like you have more breathing room. That's a little bit of a dabbling with this idea of I can have more variation in my pace to my work.
All right. The third principle of slow productivity is obsess over quality. Let's go into this one.
Well, these first two rules don't work if you don't have the third one. If you don't have that third principle, the first two are eventually just going to seem like I don't want to work and I want to go real slow.
Yeah.
By themselves, where is that going to end? Well, it might just eventually end with quiet quitting or something like this. So you have to couple it with the third principle, which is I really, really care about what I do and I want it to be really good. And it supports those other principles in two complementary ways. One, when you really begin to obsess over the quality of what you do, pseudo-productivity suddenly seems intrusive and absurd. When you say, I really care about this being really good, you say, well, then I don't want to be on Zoom meetings all day. And who cares about answering my email really quickly? What does that have to do with me making this thing really good? So it makes busyness intolerable, which is a great starting point for slow productivity. And then two, as you get better at things, the autonomy you gain to actually minimize busyness in your work life grows. The better you are, the more you can say, I don't do meetings on Mondays. I don't want to answer this email. So it's a virtuous cycle. It makes you really begin to dislike busyness, while at the same time, it begins to give you the leverage you need to minimize that busyness. So it's like the engine to the slow productivity mindset.
So Cal, one of the things underpinning slow productivity, I think, is an assumption that there's a reasonable degree of autonomy in the person's job. What about people who may react and say, look, I don't have that much agency over my workday, Cal?
Well, where it really applies well is knowledge work. And one of the defining features of knowledge work that's true once you hear it, but people don't realize it, is the extreme amount of autonomy it has, right? If you go back and look at the foundational managerial text about this new type of work when they emerged in the 50s and 60s, the word autonomy comes up all the time. Peter Drucker, who coined the term knowledge work in the 1950s, use that word throughout his entire life. I've documented this from the 50s all the way through the late 90s before he died in the early 2000s. He said, this is what defines knowledge work. It's not a factory. It's not you're at this station on an assembly line and I'm going to tell you exactly how to do your work. In knowledge work, he said, it's defined by the fact that I'm going to give you an objective. Please do this, but it's up to you to figure out how you're going to do it. And it's in that wiggle room. It's in that autonomy that slow productivity can take root. So it's not going to apply well to the service sector. It's not going to apply well to the industrial sector. It's not going to apply well to the agricultural sector. It's not going to apply well if you're an emergency room doctor or a nurse that it's given one case after another. But knowledge work and office jobs covers a big part of the economy. That's where pseudo productivity is the worst, and that's where slow productivity has the biggest potential to be applied.
So why is it that so many knowledge workers feel like they lack this autonomy then?
Well, if your pseudo-productivity is your implicit measure, the thing that you've internalized, then you feel like, how can I ever do anything but just say yes to everything and work really hard? So it's when you abandon the idea that pseudo-productivity is what really matters that suddenly you discover your autonomy. And one of the things that I think a lot of people realize as they go down this journey is that partially, like, as you deliver, you know, maybe I'm doing fewer things at once, but I'm doing stuff well. Maybe I'm working at a natural pace, but my stuff really makes a big difference and obsessing over quality. You realize if you deliver, you are given more flexibility. The Adam Grant, you know, the business writer Adam Grant calls these idiosyncrasy credits. I am producing good stuff. I have earned a right to be a little bit weird or unusual or outside of the norm about how I organize my work. So as long as you are delivering, you have more flexibility. You will earn more flexibility than you think to discover how I do my work.
What about people who've got other responsibilities, so parents, caring responsibilities? How does this work with that?
Well, they're the audience that needs this most. And in fact, it was part of my own personal motivation. So I have an academic, intellectual motivation in studying this problem. But I also had this personal motivation that, you know, I have three boys and they hit an age. When they all hit elementary school at the same time, there was this shift where suddenly they needed basically every possible minute of dad time possible. It was just, I guess, a boys and dads thing, right? So here I was, a sort of newly tenured professor who was thinking, wait a second, I need to give these boys during this relatively small window as much time as possible. That's exactly the type of environment where the principles of slow productivity make a difference. Pseudo productivity is brutal on anyone who doesn't just have full control of their time to do nothing but work. Right. If you have other things going on in your life that matter, pseudo productivity is brutal. It is frustrating. It's going to make you have to make all of these compromises that are psychologically taxing. Slow productivity is a way out of that. You can slow down. You can take your time. You can get rid of the clutter, but you can do really, really good work. I had to embrace slow productivity as my responsibilities grew.
Cal, you did mention before that, you know, working with other team members and in particular your managers is really important. So what's your message to our leaders and managers then?
If I was talking to a manager, I would say the number one thing you should care about, like tomorrow, is the workload of the people you manage. Do not just assume everyone has that under control and they're keeping track of it and it's reasonable. You should have transparency and you should have standards. You should have standards about how much work should people be doing at the same time and make sure that you don't let it get beyond that standard. And that requires transparency. You should know, like, hey, write down your big projects. Let's put them all in a central place. We'll have a column on the wall. I talk about a group that does this in the book, a column for everyone in the group. Here's the things you're working on. I don't want that to be more than two. The other stuff we need to do, I'll keep it as the manager. We'll put it on a list over here of like stuff we need to do soon, but start caring about the workload. That's the biggest impact you can have right away, is to reduce the number of things that people are working on at the same time. You will still, as a group, produce a ton of stuff. In fact, you'll probably produce more, but your team members are not going to burn out. They're going to produce better things. That would be the number one thing I would change. The very first thing I would change if I was talking to a manager.
Cal, you've got three ways listeners can try this. Can you tell us more, please?
All right, so there's some practical things you can try right away. All right, number one, for work of a type that you need to do, but there's a lot of it that comes at you, put in place quotas. All right, for these type of committees, I do at most two a month. For these type of client visits, I organize once per quarter. This allows you to still do important work, but make sure you don't do too much of the important work. And people respect quotas. If you say, yes, I love doing this stuff, but I've hit my quota for the month, they get it. All right, another simple idea that I would give is when it comes to meetings, try the one for you, one for them strategy, which means every time I schedule a meeting on my calendar, I have to find an equivalent amount of time for that same week, the block off on my calendar, for me just to work on my own stuff. And what happens here is you still have lots of times to offer to people for meetings, right? You don't have hard and fast rules about when meetings happen or not. But as you get more meetings on your calendar, you get more protected time as well. And it keeps your calendar from getting out of control. And the final thing I would recommend is that when it comes to especially the quest for quality, have a different location for the most important work you do. This is a mindset hack right here. When it comes time to do the really hard writing or coding or strategizing, leave the desk where your email is and where Zoom is. Go to the park bench. Go to the museum that's in the town where you live. Go on a hike on a nature trail. Have a dedicated sort of inspiring location for working on your most important stuff. It's going to be much more appealing to work on it, and you're going to produce much better thoughts.
Thank you so much, Cal.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Cal Newport, author of Slow Productivity, The Lost Art of Accomplishment Without Burnout. Try this and share how it's worked for you. You can email thisworkinglife@abc.net.au. Thanks for listening to This Working Life with me, Lisa Leong. If you haven't already, search for This Working Life on the ABC Listen app. Tap the heart to follow all of our stories. This episode was produced by Kate Ubigang and engineered by Carrie Dell and Tim James. We're on the lands of the Wurundjeri people in Naarm, Melbourne. Until next time, love your work.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.